Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hi, I'm Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Joshua.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. Round one, Temporal Grace. Since this is going to be going out, hopefully, on January the 1st, we thought we would start out with some Doctor Who-related New Year's resolutions.
My New Year's resolution is to listen to more Tom Baker Big Finish audios.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, I do like Big Finish, but at first when I heard some of Tom Baker's audios, I wasn't that thrilled by it. They just didn't seem to capture his period in the show. But I recently picked up Philip Hinchcliffe Presents. It's a box set, and it's ostensibly ideas from Philip Hinchcliffe, written and scripted by Mark Platt, and featuring Tom Baker and Leela. I listened to the first one. It's called The Ghosts of Gralstead, and it's a six-parter, which Big Finish rarely does, but it helps to evoke the feel of the TV show. And it is essentially Talons of Wang Chiang meets Ghostlight in style, when you've got the sort of Philip Hinchcliffe gothic ideas and then Mark Platt scripting it. But the reason I got really sucked in was because Tom Baker is actually really trying hard in this one, because some of the first audios which turned me off was that he was kind of playing 80-year-old crazy Tom Baker playing young crazy Tom Baker playing the Fourth Doctor. But he's really dialed it back, and he's seeming to really match the material, and he's playing that really early version of the Fourth Doctor.
Well, for years he like refused to do any.
Yeah. And so this was really exciting to me, and I'm really enjoying them, so I am going to go back and give them all a try.
I have one too. This podcast has inspired me to go back and finish reading the last several novels in the BBC Books Eighth Doctor range.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so some many years ago, before the Chris Eccleston series had started, I was assiduously reading this series of books, starting from about the time that the Eighth Doctor was trapped on Earth, with things like the Turing test and escape velocity, whatever, and I read them all the way through to, I think, I want to say, Justin Richards' novel, Sometime Never, which is about seven books before the series ended. And I'd like to just sort of finish that up for my own personal satisfaction.
Bragging rights.
Who else has done that? Right. But more particularly to get to the final book in the series, which is written by Lance Parkin. It's called The Gallifrey Chronicles. Lance Parkin has the distinction of writing the last Virgin Novels adventure and the last BBC Books adventure. So he wrote The Dying Days, and then he wrote The Gallifrey Chronicles, where Gallifrey is restored, having been destroyed in the Eighth Doctor series of books. It's restored in Lance Parkin's novel. And then, of course, it's destroyed in a completely different way by the time the Chris Eccleston series starts. Only to be restored later. And I guess if we can go down this rabbit hole a little bit longer, Lance Parkin is, of course, also the guy that wrote A History, which is this kind of mad attempt to synthesize every bit of Doctor Who fiction into a coherent chronology.
Oh, wow.
So, from the books and from the audios and from the TV series, he's written increasingly larger versions of this book.
So he updates it.
I think it's in the third edition now. I think there may be a fourth edition coming.
I have no idea
how he reconciles the fact that Gallifrey was destroyed and recreated at least twice and at least once under his watch.
Yeah. That sounds like fascinating reading. I would put my life aside to read that book.
Probably. I think the latest version is longer than War and Peace. It literally is longer. And that's my resolution. Kelvin, do you have one?
I would like to resolve to eat less frozen pizza. I rely on frozen pizza way, way too frequently for quick dinners.
It's a lot of sodium.
And it's not really something you're supposed to eat, you know, multiple times a week.
How can Doctor Who help you with that?
That's a good question. I think, well, maybe if I just ate more jelly babies instead of frozen pizza.
Carrot juice?
Carrot juice. Carrot juice is a good healthy thing to consume.
I've been juicing recently.
Yeah. I've heard that, yes. Yeah,
and I've lost weight. We could juice together.
Okay, I will come by and get juice.
And now it's time for round two, Special Topics Dalek. Today, Josh is going to surprise us with an unexpected discussion topic. Take it away, Josh.
Thank you, and this is almost verging on an essay question. I apologize in advance. So, over the whole 50-plus years of the show, the Doctor's attitudes towards violence have fluctuated, I think, somewhat dramatically, and at his most extreme, he's been portrayed as both a pacifist and an executioner. Is this contradiction compelling or inconsistent? Is there a way to reconcile these different aspects of the character, or do you think there's like an ideal point on the spectrum between pacifist and aggressor that represents the truest version of the Doctor?
It is kind of like an essay question. It's kind of like a scatter plot. Right? You need, you know, take all of the different doctors and their attitudes toward violence, and you plot them on a graph, and see if you can get
Nate Silver on this.
Let's get Nate Silver. See if we get median and mean and the particular curve, and see if there's a trend somewhere or another. But I see where you're going with this, right? Because it really is all over the place. Yeah. And some of that is emergent because it's just over the course of 50 years, you have different script editors and directors and actors doing things.
And some society of changes.
Attitudes toward violence are changing. The audience is changing, more children-oriented in the first years, more fan-oriented later on, now some kind of strange mixture of the two. Between David Tennant refusing to even punch somebody in The Doctor's Daughter and Matt Smith just flat out leaving that guy to die in Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Or, I don't remember the entire mechanics of the storyline, but when Matt Smith plants the post-hypnotic suggestion in the human race to just kill all of the silence on sight, and he turns the entire human race into his army.
It's a lot different than, but do I have the right to destroy the Dalek race in Genesis of the Daleks? Yeah, and
it strikes me that in the new series now, they're trying to find a way to bring what were disparate elements that were based on, as you said, different writers, different changes in the climate, and try to make them into a cohesive character. But it seems often quite inconsistent. Even in Tennant was probably where the whole pacifism kind of came to the surface again, it strikes me, because he made a lot of speeches about that he was better than that, and a lot of angry rants about guns. But he also had those family of blood moments where he imprisons and tortures all that whole family in some way. Or even his opening episode where he says he's the no second chances doctor. So it doesn't always gel, even within one creator vision.
He tries to find a pacifist solution and an understanding solution, and then sometimes that clearly just isn't going to work anymore. So he doesn't and does something violent. It sounds like the sort of thing our political leaders just tend to say, you know, which is, well, yeah, that was terrible, but we're the good guys, and we know what we're doing.
There is a lot of moral justification inherent in him just being the Doctor.
I really don't want to compare the Doctor to world leaders or anything like that, but, you know, it's...
But he is.
It's more acceptable when I see the Doctor doing it because I know he's the Doctor. I know he's a fictitious character. I know he has an awareness and knowledge of things that's kind of beyond what any of us are going to have.
Well, that's the fantasy element where you're willing to give him that moral authority, and it's like, it'd be great if one person could just be right. and you're enjoying the show that way.
It kind of runs up against the limits of what we expect from our storytelling, too. So you read a mystery novel or a Sherlock Holmes story or something like that. You accept that there's a kind of fantastical or supernatural element in the detecting ability of the character. And we go with that, even though in the real world we would find that preposterous. With Doctor Who, it and with most adventure stories, there's a character or a number of characters who can be seen to be morally correct. They can somehow see to the heart of a problem that would be irresolvable in the real world. Why is he hanging around with UNIT and army people?
Yeah, I mean that's always been kind of a thing, you know, his relationship with the military, because he does work with the military, but he's clearly not what you would ever describe of as a pro-military person.
But he surrounds himself with people who are willing and able to use violence to resolve the problem. Like you said earlier, like he'll talk a lot about pacifism and diplomatic solutions, and we've talked about this in earlier podcasts too, but often the solution is violent in nature, and even if the doctor isn't doing it, someone is doing it on his behalf. But it's not just UNIT, there's River Song.
I'm not going to use guns because I'm Batman, but you can use guns.
Exactly. I'm pious about not using guns, but I'm going to surround myself with people who do, and they'll solve the problems that are left unresolved by my pacifism.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that in the David Tennant years.
And I think that's where it stands out to me as a glaring inconsistency, when there's a little more hypocrisy. I think Pertwee's doctor had it, again, because he's hanging out with the military. He does the Venusian Aikido all the time, but then he does go on a lot of moralizing, nonviolent speeches as well, even though he's kind of steeped in it.
There's a difference between his Venusian Aikido that'll knock somebody out and shooting somebody with a machine gun.
I think a fairly key thing is, have you ever really seen the Doctor enjoy being violent?
Yes. Colin Baker's first season, he was like, bring it. You know, whether it be mowing down Cybermen or killing Shockeye with the cyanide.
There's a strange scene in Day of the Daleks, the John Pertwee adventure, where the Doctor just up and takes a ray gun and starts blowing away Ogrons. Like they're rushing at him, just shooting people. What the heck? I have never seen that in a Doctor. No matter, even Colin Baker notwithstanding, I've never seen the Doctor just straight up shoot people.
Yeah, I think that stands out. But yet, is that so weird compared to other things he's more than willing to stand by and let happen? And so that is that weird line that seems to be drawn, where if he actively does it, picks up a gun, it's out of character. But if he manipulates the situation or lets the military come in and do it.
Yeah, in my ideal conception of the Doctor, he's a man of nonviolence who wants to negotiate and try diplomatic solutions under all circumstances, but is a realist enough to know that at a certain point that has to stop. You can't negotiate with the Daleks, for example.
Yeah.
And that he's willing to commit a certain amount of violence to stop much worse things from happening. And so that's kind of my ideal understanding of the Doctor. And it deviates on various sides of that, depending on who's writing it and who's acting it.
Yeah, he's pretty gosh darn pragmatic.
He is. What did you think when they took that pragmatism all the way up to, like, the last couple seasons of the Sylvester McCoy years, where he was just cleaning house, essentially, realizing he had let the Cybermen go too long, the Daleks go too long, and he's blowing up Skaro, and he's wiping out the Cybermen fleet. And the implication, again, is that I played this game long enough, enough people have died,
taking
them out.
To me, that's the upper limit of what the Doctor should be. I can see that being within his character, that he doesn't take a joy in it, and he's not a sadist.
And particularly with the Daleks, it had a nice callback to the, at least twice, with both the fourth and fifth Doctor, where he had a chance to stop Davros, and either the Daleks in Genesis of the Daleks or Resurrection of the Daleks, when he had Davros at gunpoint.
Yeah, I'd been leading up to it for a while.
Yes.
And I particularly like the last Christopher Eccleston episode, The Parting of the Ways, as that deliberate callback and inversion of mostly Genesis of the Daleks, but also some of the Seventh Doctor stuff there, where he decides it is impossible for him to kill half the people on Earth to wipe out the Daleks. He can't do it.
Yeah.
He's already destroyed Gallifrey. He can't take on the moral responsibility of doing that, which on a practical level is terrible, right? Because it just means a lot of people are going to die. The Doctor has totally failed. But on a character level, you can see where it had been building for a long time.
Have you ever seen the Doctor being violent while being angry?
David Tennant got angry a lot.
The Doctor clearly gets angry a bunch.
Matt Smith seems to get angry and threaten violence a lot, but then calm down. I'm thinking of A Town Called Mercy at gunpoint, throwing the war criminal out across the border.
You can almost forgive violence and anger more than you can
crime of passion stuff. What violence is worse than other kinds of violence? You know, is clearly the Doctor doesn't take an absolutist stance on it, and I don't know if I do either.
That's what annoyed me so much about The Doctor's Daughter, where David, this was the furthest example of David Tennant just getting irritated at people being violent in any sort of way. Mm-hmm. Like somebody, I don't remember the details, somebody punches somebody else out. This is the kind of thing that John Pertwee did as a matter of course. but Tennant got all kind of indignant about it. Whereas I don't even understand how you can tell a Doctor Who story without somebody there to punch somebody out at some point. Yeah. How do you even get from point A to point B without somebody punching somebody out?
It would just be like, you know, that first season of the Super Friends cartoon on Saturday morning and how ridiculously awful it was because they could not show any violence in it.
Yeah, I don't want my Doctor Who to be like the first season of Super Friends.
Never.
I don't want much of anything to be like the first season.
But this is the reductio ad absurdum? Is that the phrase of pacifism, right? It's pacifism is wonderful in principle, but at some point it means that you're actively complicit in things that you don't want to happen.
Exactly.
So if you say you will fight under absolutely no circumstances, as the Doctor seems to be saying in The Doctor's Daughter, and nowhere else, because he's always willing to fight for something, then that just means that you're allowing everything else to happen around you. You stand for nothing, you have no principles, and you just allow everyone else to make your decisions for you, and that might be morally satisfactory for you personally, but it means that you're not exerting a real moral force in the world.
This idea from the new series that the Doctor gets violent or cares less when he travels alone. I think it started with David Tennant, but it's a lot in the Matt Smith. It came up in A Town Called Mercy.
You mentioned it in the Snowman episode.
That he shouldn't travel alone because he turns into this darker, less moral character.
It's a bit schematic.
Yeah.
You would think that somebody who's around for several hundred years might learn how to be alone every now and then without all of a sudden becoming a total misanthrope.
So in my ideal world, I think I'm in utter agreement with you guys that he has a line in the sand that he won't really cross for violence, and it's not his first solution, and he is appealing because if he can talk his way out of something rather than fight his way out of it, he'd rather do it. Partly the reason I think it's appealing too is I think sometimes that just comes out of pure cockiness, and he seems to just enjoy the fact that you have a gun and I don't, and I just won. It's not always out of a moral high ground.
Right.
Especially with Tom Baker, I think he just loves to be able to just beat somebody up with his quips.
Yeah, this is kind of our ideal Doctor,
yes.
And we can see deviations on either side of that. And anybody can point to examples that disprove what we're saying, but I think we're kind of in agreement on.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not possible for something to be around as long as Doctor Who and have it have some kind of absolutely consistent
not
moral
if it's
viewpoint.
Written and acted by completely different people.
Yeah.
I'd just like to see him be a little less tortured over it going forward.
Be a man, Doctor.
Be a man. Man up. And now round three, the randomizer. In this round, we randomly choose an adventure from the classic series to discuss. And today, we'll be talking about The Time Monster. Now, this is a John Pertwee story.
Six episodes.
We keep getting the long ones.
It is the third, I believe, explanation for Atlantis, or
yes,
at least the story of what happens to Atlantis. I think it was in The Underwater Menace and another Pertwee one.
The Daemons.
Yes.
It is the second to last Roger Delgado master story.
It has the one-shot TARDIS interior. I don't think
the fishbowl
roundels.
They didn't use the giant mixing bowls or whatever it was.
So it has a lot of distinguishing qualities. I'm just going to come out right now and start this by saying, when we picked this last episode, I was like, oh, great. I have to sit through 6 episodes of The Time Monster, and I have 100% changed my opinion. I love this to death rewatching it, and I can't even quite remember why I didn't like it. I can see why people wouldn't, but I can't.
Fandom hates it.
It's a widely disliked story. It has a few outright goofy and weird moments that I don't think work, but I think it's a very underrated story.
I was struck immediately by the intentionality of it. It is a campier style. It reminds me basically of Doctor Who does 60s Batman, because it has a lot of things like Bessie's super drive with a box on it that's marked super drive,
yes,
and inertia brakes, and the doctor tells Joe to push that button. It's marked in times of emergency or something, very much like a comic book.
Well, I really grooved on The Time Monster, too. I never hated it as much as fandom seems to. And what struck me watching it this time was that this is the kind of thing that you can't show to somebody who doesn't already know Doctor Who. A lot of the Bill Hartnell and Patrick Troughton episodes are analogous to other things that were going on. This is an alien invasion story, kind of like this alien invasion movie, or it's a historical drama that's kind of like this other thing you've seen. But here, you have all of these quintessentially crazy Doctor Who things. You've got time travel, you've got the UNIT family, Tom Tit, you know, and now they're in Atlantis, and the Doctor's building the weird time-space analog thing, and then they're stopping for tea in the middle of this crisis. This is all so Doctor Who. It's not like anything else.
No.
And if you're not already attuned to the cadences of the show, you're not really going to get what this is about.
And particularly this era of the show with the whole UNIT family and how cozy. Everyone knows each other. I had forgotten how much even the Masters knows everyone's name. He's like, I'll get you, Sergeant Benton. And it's very chummy. This has to be, I think, one of Roger Delgado's best episodes. He is just having so much fun as the Master. His dialogue, he's just relishing every moment of evil, and there's so much banter. And again, it's not just banter with the Doctor. He's having fun fighting all of UNIT.
He drops a V1 on my
he drops a V.
And he says, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
It's an interesting story because all the different supporting characters really kind of have something to do. Sergeant Benton
gets turned into a baby.
He gets turned into a baby, but he also does that thing where he opens the window in the lab so he can get the drop on the Master. And I like that the Brigadier recognizes the V1 right away.
He's old enough. Joe doesn't know the noise.
He's old enough to like get, oh my God, that's can't be what I think it is.
The other nice moment,
yeah,
is when after the explosion happens, he goes, Mike! It's the only time he calls Captain Yates Mike.
Yeah,
I think.
He drops the military.
Yeah, when he thinks he's been
conventions.
Killed.
Yeah. And Joe often gets kind of picked on as like one of the dumber companions, but she actually is kind of on the ball, I think.
She starts episode one by saying, I know I'm exceedingly dim.
One of the things I find the most interesting about this, and it touches on a lot of elements of the story, is there is a really clear through line that addresses sexism and gender roles and does a lot of weird flipping of them. We have Joe as the subservient assistant to the Doctor, and then it's flipped on its head with Ruth and Stu being the subservient assistant character. And Ruth is making a lot of comments about, what does she say? For a so-called member of the opposite sex, you're being surprisingly feeble. And at one point she actually tells Sergeant Benton to just stand there and look pretty. She reverses tons of those things, and it's just spread throughout it. Or when Kronos appears and she's a woman and they're shocked and she states, shape means nothing.
Well, it's so much of its period. They talk about women's liberation, and there's all of this idea of how are the gender roles going to shake out. Mm-hmm. And so they're playing with all of that in the same way that they're playing with a lot of New Age nonsense, mm-hmm, all of the race memory stuff they talk about, Atlantis, which was a big thing in the time, prophetic dreams. Barry Letts' Buddhism pops there with the Doctor's discussion of his monk friend.
That's honestly one of my favorite Third Doctor moments.
It's quiet. It's touching because of Pertwee and Katie Manning, they have a good rapport. It's in one of those moments where they're tied up together and they have little chats. That happens every so often. I remember Frontier in Space having like a lot of that. Yes. And of course, it recurs in Planet of the Spiders when you actually meet Kanpo, the monkey's talking about.
And there's a nice echo of Listen. He's talking about his childhood, how unhappy he was at the time. I thought of Listen right away, not a direct connection, yeah. But it tweaked my little nerd brain.
The other connections would be the quotation, "It was the daisiest daisy I've ever seen," which is a little bit twee and ridiculous, but it's the John Pertwee quote they choose to use in Day of the Doctor when mm-hmm. they have the other doctors seeping in. And also the guy who plays the King of Atlantis, George Cormack, is the guy who goes on to play Kanpo in Planet of the Spiders. So he is the monk.
Retroactive continuity. But, you know, the interesting thing about the sexism discussion to me is that there's a lot of that in this 70s Doctor Who, but it's usually sort of a topical throwaway line, and no one really embraces it. But it seems to be carried through in a more intentional way throughout the script, right down to the end where the Doctor and the Master are having this childish pissing war over the time ram, and it's Joe who finally just goes, "Oh, for crying out loud," and rams them. That was one of the most proactive Joe Grant moments I recall.
I like it also when she just straight up jumps onto the Master to try to stop him, but she's so little and he just carries her into the TARDIS.
He just walks into the TARDIS.
It's like, that's a great attempt.
It seems in this story that you really see the Doctor and the Master really fighting each other. Their TARDISes are inside each other, and so they're having the arguments over the monitor.
I love that episode.
And, you know, it's like they really are in a very direct kind of conflict.
I feel like they know each other, that there's a real history.
Yeah.
There's both a strange animosity and camaraderie between them in those scenes.
There's a joy in irritating each other that I like a lot.
Very childish.
Delgado flicks a switch and makes John Pertwee talk backwards for a few minutes just so he can irritate him and not have to listen.
I don't want to listen to you! A lot of little fun things in here, like the Master suddenly summoning roundheads from the English Civil War to, like, fight people for no reason.
And he had the great line of, what is it, 17th century poltroons?
Yeah.
The Master's full of terrific lines. The tribal taboos of army etiquette, referring to the Brigadier unit.
Yeah, I don't get why this... I suppose it's...
People think it's too lighthearted, obviously, and it is silly and it's ridiculous, but I guess when I'm looking at an episode, I'm looking at author intent, and this seems to be really intentional and cohesive, as opposed to something being silly because the special effect didn't work out, or the actor's hamming it up, or it's a lazy script. I think the lines are really funny. They're intentionally written in this style. I can see if this just isn't your taste in Doctor Who, but it gels.
They build a big structure in which they can play around a lot. Oh, the Master's just got this kind of latest nonsense happening. Okay, and then so UNIT can do their things. And then for an episode or two, we're going to pop back into Atlantis to be in a different place. And that's the part of it that doesn't really jibe with the rest of the story, although I think it works equally well on its own terms.
Yeah. The weird wine bottle and fork and keys thing that the Doctor makes that somehow screws up what the Master's doing. What?
That's it, man. It's a Doctor Who shibboleth. You either get it or you don't. And even most Doctor Who fans can't go with that.
Let's just grab a bunch of random household objects and create time-stopping magic.
But that's the thing, it's time-stopping magic. So what real science would you use to create time-stopping magic? I mean,
something that actually, I don't know.
It doesn't bother me. I find it charming in the context of this episode because it is in line with everything else, with inertia brakes, with superdrive buttons.
The other thing that really bugs me is just the basic design of Kronos isn't good.
Like, Kronos is a pretty bird.
And then the angry bird thing. I don't know why they went with that.
I will say this. I don't know what has made me become the defender of the Time Monster, but I am taking up this mantle. I agree, the costume is not strong, but it's one of those nice times in Doctor Who where the director seems to recognize that, and I think the way it's shot with the softer light, and I find the flapping really disturbing, and I think mainly it's the shots where you don't see much of the Time Monster, but you see the kind of flicker of lights as the wings are clearly flapping. For such a not great costume, it was realized pretty well on screen in the
I appreciate that they kind of didn't film it like head on very much.
Yeah, because then there would have been nothing scary about
it.
But it suggested the idea of this like massive, intimidating form of energy in a Flappy Bird chicken costume.
And you could have spent a couple more minutes coming up with an acronym for the time device.
Okay, let's just talk about
little,
Tom Tit.
That was
just
a little less Tom dumb Tit on than the Tom Tit.
Yes. I have a legitimate question. Is Tit not a slang in England? Is it?
Absolutely it is.
Tit is totally
It's been a slang
and it
for
is
hundreds
so
of years.
Funny. When they come in, especially the first introduction of it, and they all have to say it like six times in a row. The
regular
comes in and says, Tom Tit, and they're Tom Tit, say, what did you say? I said Tom Tit. It's like a Monty Python sketch.
The administrator of the institute, like, what is this Tom Tit? You know, like, he really, really overemphasizes it.
I think somebody's being juvenile. Are these supposed to make kids laugh? They made us laugh.
It did. I loved it.
There's an oddly, you know, kind of hinting at sexual humor. And there was some other moment that seemed like weirdly...
Ingrid Pitt's cleavage?
That's the other distraction in the show.
That tended to draw my focus quite a bit.
And that seems out of step with the rest of Doctor Who. I'm trying to imagine any other time where there's that much cleavage.
There's Perry getting later. In this period, there's lots of leg.
There was some other moment with Joe that had a lot of innuendo with it, but
I know what it is. I know exactly what it is. It's when she's looking at the crystal in episode 5, and she says, "It's beautiful, but at the same time horrible. It gives me a funny feeling."
Oh, there's the scene where the master pops up on the view screen when they're making the coccyx jokes and says, "I'm sorry about your coccyx, Miss Grant." And they cut to Benton saying, "I don't think we should touch it." It made me laugh. And that could not have been accidental, at least in the editing room.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, boom, back to back.
I could see, you know, if you were watching this story fresh, it has a pretty terrible title.
The Time Monster?
The Time Monster is kind of a lame
see,
title.
This is one of those dangerous grounds. You can't start ripping into Doctor Who titles because the entire House of Cards comes down.
It could only be more Doctor Who if it was The Time of Monster or The Monster of Time.
The Monster of Time would be really Doctor Who-ish.
That sounds more like Sesame Street. Cookie Monster is going to teach you about learning how to tell
time.
So before we leave The Time of Monster, I just have to mention a couple of my favorite lines from it. Like I said, everything the King of Atlantis says is gold, but he immediately knows that the Master is not an emissary of the gods.
Oh, when the Master tries to hypnotize him and he just laughs
at him.
He
just laughs at him and he says, "Oh, if you're an emissary of the gods or whatever, tell me then of great Poseidon. What did he have for breakfast? Fish, I suppose."
There is really funny dialogue in here.
Well, that was the other thing I wanted to mention is I was kind of impressed with the design of Atlantis because they appear to have been inspired by, and I can't remember the exact term for it, but the really ancient Greece. Was it the Cycladic era?
The Cycladic Islands.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pre-Minoan.
Yeah, you know, before the Greeks had really figured out how to make anything we think of as Greek yet, kind of Egyptian-y, and they had the statue of the woman with, like, the big skirt, and it's kind of
Yeah, they're very featureless statues. There's some examples of them over here at the Minnesota Institute of Arts. Mm. They look kind of like abstracted masks. They have long... Well, anyway.
Maybe that's less... impressive in England where they have an educational system. But I was kind of impressed that they were inspired by that look.
I had this whole thing that I noted down that I'm not going to bother anybody with, where the King of Atlantis does seem to be reminiscent of the Athenian Senator Demosthenes, and he's talking about Alexander the Great, and oh, never mind. But someone clearly knew their business when they were writing all of that, and I like it's just kind of in the background. It floats through it, and it's done in a kind of childish and funny way. But for me, this is totally Doctor Who. This is exactly the kind of thing that you love if you love Doctor Who and you accept all of the dumb pink snake level Kronos design problems. But how can you not love this if you're not
a
Doctor
Who fan? So essentially we're saying that if you don't like the Time Monster, you're not a true fan.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, round 4.
wonderful, a wonderful, wonderful, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful,
Hi there. This is Joshua, and I've traveled back in time to the evening of December 19th, 2014, the evening we originally recorded this very episode, just so I could share some thoughts on Last Christmas, Peter Capaldi's very first Christmas special. But since Last Christmas is still in our past selves' futures, we've locked them safely in a time loop kind of bubble balloon animal thing. So, don't worry, we can spoil the living crap out of the Christmas special without causing any damage to the web of time stream continuum vortex thing. Unfortunately, Calvin tried to time scoop himself, uncomfortable, and ended up trapped in a time eddy, like a whirlpool eddy. I mean, not a guy named Eddie, because that'd be weird. Ooh, I'm getting a signal from Pat, future Pat. Let's hear what he has to say, Pat.
Hello, younger selves. I'm speaking to you from the other side of Christmas in 2015, and let me tell you, the future here is crazy. You just wouldn't believe it. Anyway, the Space-Time Telegraph has summoned me to share my opinions about the Last Christmas episode. So like a lot of people, I have a very mixed attitude towards Christmas. I do look forward to it. I like spending time with family and other loved ones, but it causes me tons of stress, and usually by the time the day actually arrives, I'm so worked up that I just grit my teeth and wait for it to be over so I can get back to my normal life. I feel exactly the same way about the Doctor Who Christmas episodes, and so that's the context when my wife and I were watching the episode late at Christmas on Christmas night, after lots of anxiety and, in my case, a lot to drink. So that's why the first time I watched it, I hated it so much. Oh my God, you guys, I hated it more than any new Doctor Who episode since Planet of the Dead. I hated its dumb jokes and the snotty elves and its childish sentimentality, all the meta-aliens jokes and its blah, 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 is it a dream or isn't it plotting. The only thing I liked about it was Peter Capaldi, who seemed to be super pissed off during the whole thing. Now, speaking to you from the future, I've watched it again, and I am considerably less Grinch-like. In fact, I liked it. I genuinely laughed at Santa's sleigh being bigger on the inside, and the aliens, that's really offensive. No wonder everybody keeps invading you. Also, I never thought I'd see a Videodrome reference on a Christmas Doctor Who episode. I still think there's a little too much self-aware metafictional irony, and every Christmas is Last Christmas, yeah, yeah, and I'm still not sure about whether I'm happy about Clara staying on, but her old age sequence made me tear up this time, now that I wasn't such a grumpy pants, and I'm glad they didn't take the cheap feel-good way out and bring Danny back, and so maintained a little real tragedy. Also buried in the story is the kind of complicated double idea that first, all of the nice stories we tell ourselves about Christmas or Santa or meeting our dead loved ones again are all just anesthetic, covering up a darker reality, a kind of a trap. But the story also acknowledges the value of these sorts of stories in bringing us together, especially at those times of year when we know we might not ever see one another again. So this is fairly complex stuff for a Santa Claus story. And actually then, I've come around 180 degrees on Last Christmas. In fact, I really don't know what I was objecting to on Christmas night, unless it was just life in general. It's a Christmas miracle, you guys. And I'll see you in the future.
Interesting review, Pat. Thanks. And it goes to show why you never want past drunk self to cross paths with future sober self. And you definitely don't want them to watch the same episode of Doctor Who. It causes massive cognitive dissonance, also known as the Blinovich inebriation effect. Very dangerous. Now, while Pat was talking, I was able to get Kelvin out of Eddie. The Eddie, the whirlpool time Eddie. Not a guy named Eddie, it's not weird. Kelvin?
All right, this is Kelvin with some quick thoughts on Last Christmas. Basically, I liked it pretty well as a standalone episode, as part of a larger ongoing arc for Doctor Who. I liked it less. Basically, I liked the story with maybe the problem of revealing the Santa thing a little too early in the story. Santa should not have shown up right away in the story. He should have shown up later as a more of a surprise reveal. But then again, I understand that when you've got a big deal guest star like Nick Frost, whom I love, you probably want to have him show up early in the story for basic marketing and promotional purposes. So, okay, I get that. But I think it would have been a lot stronger story if the Santa craziness showed up much later in the show. Part of why I liked the show as much as I did is because I was braced for it to be really terrible. I was expecting some kind of big tearful reunion between Clara and Danny. You know, Danny comes back from the dead somehow, and or they, you know, and they have some ridiculous storybook romance for all time. And I was also very prepared for this to be Clara's last episode because there was a bunch of rumors about that. So while I'm glad they didn't have a Danny resurrection, and I think Danny should stay dead at this point, I was kind of taken aback and disappointed that Clara is still around, because again, I really don't see why Clara and the 12th Doctor are hanging out together. They don't make sense together for me at all. And also, she seems to be entirely over Danny's death now, so Clara all of a sudden seems to have severe emotional problems. You know, like, suddenly she's, like, the most in-love person in the world, and she's never going to love again. And now it's like, oh, dump-de-dump-de-dump, off with the Doctor again. And that bothers me. And again, I think it's a consequence of trying, you know, the show trying to do everything at once and try to do all this stuff in a long story arc and characterization things all at the same time in one episode. And I don't... It's just too much, and as a result, characterization gets the short shift, and you have things like Clara suddenly behaving like she's insane. So, in short, largely liked it as a standalone, didn't like it so much as a part of the ongoing arc of things, so that's my oversimplified synopsis of Last Christmas. This has been Kelvin. Thanks.
Thanks, Kelvin. And now, it's time for my review. Oh, great, the cloister bell. Means I have to get back to the future to finish editing this damn thing. Real quick, here's my review. Essentially, I agree with Pat and Kelvin. I was pretty sure I was gonna hate this, like, more than drunk Pat hated it, but as it turned out, I was pleasantly surprised. Yes, it was a lot of recycled Moffat tropes, but the jokes made me laugh. Capaldi was fantastic. Coleman was fantastic. The guest cast was very strong. I'm like Kelvin. I'm not quite satisfied with Clara's emotional arc, but honestly, I haven't really been satisfied with any emotional arcs in all of New Who, and I've kind of come to the conclusion that emotional arcs are New Who's equivalent of Classic Who's wobbly sets. You're just going to have to go with it if you want to enjoy it. So, that's what I did. That's right, I'm hand-waving the hell out of this one. Okay, yeah, I'm going, okay? Jeez, this thing's worse than my kids. That's it. See you guys in 2015.
Final round, the Death Zone. In this round, we are going to decide who is the best. The Master? Or 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 the Master?
So many Masters. On that point, we're going to narrow our Masters down, I think, to TV Masters. Because if you include B. BBC Books, the Virgin Books, and there's also some new audio masters. Big Finish has added a new Eighth Doctor era master that's a totally new version played by, I have it here, Alex McQueen.
Okay.
But Ferdinand was close, Kelvin.
Yeah.
There's an Eighth
Doctor. It was not Ferdinand McGillicuddy.
There's an Eighth Doctor master in the comic strips from yes. Doctor Who Monthly as well. Yeah.
So pretty much every entertainment medium had a different post-survival or post-TV movie version of the master. But for our discussion, we'll be talking about Roger Delgado, of course, the original and presumably 13th master. Peter Pratt, playing again the presumably cadaverous form of the Delgado master. Jeffrey Beavers, playing Peter Pratt, playing the cadaverous form of Delgado master. Anthony Ainley as the Tremos master. Eric Roberts as the Bruce master. Derek Jacobi as the resurrected master. And then we get our first really on-screen regeneration of the master with John Sim. Mm-hmm. And most recently, Michelle Gomez. There might be something in discussing what we think the master character really is. There's a part of me that thinks that people in fandom like a sort of ideal version of the master that in some ways has never really made it to screen, this Moriarty figure. But I feel it's kind of hard because the Doctor is more complex than the master. So the master never really becomes this dark reflection of the Doctor.
It's the problem with the recurring villains in general. If they just fail every time they go up against the hero, then how can you take them seriously after a while? And that happened very quickly with Roger Delgado. He became this kind of camp figure and almost seemed chummy with the unit guys. Mm-hmm. And inevitably he would team up with some alien race and, oh my God, they betrayed him. Oh, who could have predicted?
What are the odds?
So then with Anthony Ainley, they went a little more insane.
It's like the master evolved from being a sort of Lex Luthor type villain to more like the Joker.
And that really starts, I think there's hints of it in Eric Roberts' performance, but it really starts with John Sim.
Well, yeah, John Sim is the first, like, just flat out, I'm just here to create chaos. Michelle Gomez gets more into the other aspect of the Joker-Batman relationship where the Joker very specifically has some kind of weird mind game he's playing with Batman.
Yeah, like a lot of new series stuff, they get a lot of mileage out of taking subtext from the old series and making it explicit. So all of this business with John Pertwee and Roger Delgado, where they seem to have this kind of homoerotic relationship between the two of them, has now been made explicit, first in David Tennant and John Sim, and then heterosexualized with Peter Capaldi and
well, that they
Gomez.
Clearly knew each I guess other I just, like for hundreds of years.
Any sort of homoerotic, I think, relationship between the master and John Pertwee is really stretching it. They just seem so much
really?
Like, to me, they seem so much like school kids or siblings.
I have always kind of felt like they were related on some level, like they were brothers or
it
something.
It has that family quality to me.
That's why, like, in the Time Monster, you have the master in disguise working on his time machine thing in 1972, where the Doctor is, as opposed to, like, any other period of history he could go to. He's clearly doing it there, because that's where the Doctor is.
It just has that passive-aggressive family quality. Yeah. It's like Christmas dinner with the Master again.
He's intentionally dicking with the Doctor. I mean, it's the only thing that makes that choice make sense, like why he went to that comparatively technologically unadvanced era of 1972.
I think it's more a reflection on the contemporary period where we over-sexualize everything. There's certainly sexual content in the classic series and sexual subtext, but there I just never got it. Especially between Delgado and Pertwee, I can't think of
You know,
anything.
This might actually be like something deep in our family histories. I don't have a brother that's about my age. I have siblings who are much, much younger than me, so I don't think about things in terms of sibling relationships as peers. Mm-hmm. When I think of male-male relationships, I think of complex friend relationships.
Yeah.
And so that's the model I see between the Doctor and the Master. You know, I don't see a brother relationship.
There's obviously a lot of competition, and maybe that's what makes me think sibling or family. It doesn't even have to be sibling. There just seems something familial in there.
There was one guy I knew in college who was very insistent, and I wish I could remember his reasoning for this, but he was insistent that the master was the doctor's son.
I can see it as a retcon.
Like some sort of rebellious son thing.
It gives a slight bit of moral justification to the many, many times the doctor should have killed the master and yes. let him go, which in the otherwise dismal Death in Heaven that we talked about a few weeks ago, Jenna Coleman, Clara has the terrific line at the end that if you ever let this creature live, everything she does after this point is down to you, which mm-hmm. is something that is absolutely true. It's something you think about Batman and the Joker all yep. the time. Every time you don't kill this person, you are responsible, at least in part, for all of the
Every
horror
death that happens afterwards.
Yeah, and so finally, at least then, Peter Capaldi does seem willing to kill the master to end all that. Even if we know that the master is going to come back, it still is morally a little clearer than those early John Pertwee episodes where he just seems to, oh, that goofy master got away again.
Well, he'll kill his way back eventually.
Yeah. We'll get him and throw him in jail for a day or two.
You know, I'm trying to dissociate this from my tendency to just, well, this was my first exposure to this element of Doctor Who, so therefore it's my favorite, which is kind of a tendency everyone has. But I do kind of like the either Peter Pratt or Jeffrey Beavers decrepit undead master, because I think the first time I ever saw the master was The Deadly Assassin.
That's the first time I'd seen him, too.
He also has the most clear motivation of all the masters, which is trying not to die.
It's that survival thing. It's interesting, too, because then I think, hands down, Anthony Ainley's best performance is in Survival, his last appearance. And he has actual personal stakes, not this vague, I want to take over the universe. He needs to get off that friggin' planet.
I'd also say Planet of Fire, he does a great performance in that, but that is for similar stakes.
Yep.
Anthony Ainley is knocked a lot in fandom. I think he wasn't an easy person to work with, mm-hmm. and he didn't have great scripts, and he wasn't an enthusiastic Doctor Who personality. But there's a lot of his stuff that I like a lot. Planet of Fire is one. Survival, although I'm not a big fan of the story itself, I think he's quite good. And when he is not laughing so maniacally, I think he can be a really solid adversary. You know.
But it's kind of the same as Delgado. Delgado, like, they make him show up so much that sometimes it just feels forced and phoned in, and then, like, every three or four appearances, it feels like he feels vital again.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the same as Anthony Ainley.
So, and then there's Eric Roberts, and there's Michelle Gomez.
And John Sim.
Oh, and John Sim.
John Sim. That's where we
you
start.
You hate John Sim, Josh.
Did not like his performance. I don't hate John Sim. I did not like his performance as the master. I felt it was just too much like the Joker, and he lacked a threatening quality. To me, he lacked those two essential things. Either he has to be kind of smooth and suave, or he has to be really dangerous and scary, and he seemed to lack either one, to me.
Yeah, I have a hard time separating out the actor's performance and with the script, and I think it was more of a script problem.
It very well could be. I mean, those are a couple of the worst scripts that I think Russell Davies has churned out.
I really couldn't stand Last of the Time Lords.
But I agree about 50%. I loved The Sound of Drums.
Part of why I hate Last of the Time Lords so much is because it squandered all the possible setup that The Sound of Drums was doing.
That's exactly right. Of course they were going to roll back time. They couldn't have 10% of the Earth be murdered permanently.
Yeah.
But at the end of The Sound of the Drums, it's one of the best cliffhangers that I've seen on television. It's up there with Picard being turned into a Borg or Cooper being shot at the end of the first season of the Twin Peaks. So all of, you know, Captain Jack and Martha have been captured. The Doctor has been turned into an old man. He's just standing there being supported by the crazy master and his crazy wife. And it's the sound of drums. And all the big sphere things are going and murdering everybody on Earth. It's like, wow, that's an ending. That's a great cliffhanger. And I thought up to that point, I was really on board with John Sim. He was being absolutely, totally crazy, over the top. But he was clearly being a master parody of David Tennant. Mm-hmm. He was being the master's version of who the Doctor is at that point. And then it immediately went to garbage in the next episode. And by the time they brought him back in some crazy, I don't even remember how, way with the ring. And
eats chicken really fast and wears a hoodie. And
so Michelle Gomez, the latest master, liked her a lot. Very scary.
Again, not the strongest script in the world by any means. And so I'd be curious to see her again in a better written script. So it's really hard to say that's the master.
Yeah, and they wrote her fairly one note. They wrote her a bit Anthony-ly, like I'm just going to be totally monomaniacal and I'm going to do eccentric things for no obvious reason. There's not any of this plotting. I have planned all this stuff out, and you can see how debonair and calculated I am that Roger Delgado had.
And ironically, I think with Peter Capaldi, this would have been a time to bring back a suave, dry, bantering sort of master relationship.
Like Derek Jacobi.
Yeah, that I think that was kind of a frustrating thing, is that you had Derek Jacobi, and his memory gets back. And in the 2 minutes he has with his memory getting back before he regenerates into John Sim, those 2 minutes, he's like as scary as anyone I've ever seen in Doctor Who. It's like, okay, here's serious old school, big deal British actor stuff, and we never really got to see
it was
anything come of it.
It was very effective for what it did, but it did waste the opportunity to have him back as the master, which I would still love to see. Mm. We could still see it. Anything can happen in Doctor Who. So a few words on Eric Roberts. I actually liked him. I thought it was good.
It was an odd casting choice. It was like, we have to get a
it was justified
American
by the
actor.
Plot. Yeah, I mean, he stole another body, so you're kind of justified by the weird casting because it's just the master grabbing the nearest convenient body. Mm-hmm. I remember hating it at the time, and then reviewing it, it's not that bad, but it's not going to be
that's really the TV
master.
Movie in a nutshell. Yeah. It's you hated it at the time, and now it's not that bad.
Yeah.
So final vote here on the master?
I have to go with the earliest masters. There's a really toss-up between Roger Delgado and
Peter Pratt.
Peter Pratt or Jeffrey Beavers. They both. I really like Jeffrey Beavers' work on the Big Finish audios because they kind of found a way to bring him back, and he's got that very evil, melodious, almost Boris Karloff-esque voice, and he's great in the audios too. And like you mentioned, Kelvin giving the master a real motivation, like a life and death motivation, seems to be when we get the best performances.
So I kind of got to go with Jeffrey Beavers. I don't know. Yeah. I just found that the most creepy.
Well, as usual, I will equivocate and dial in on my answer. If we see another season of Michelle Gomez, ask me again. If we were to ever see another episode of Derek Jacobi as the master, ask me again. Yeah. But as of right now, of course, it's Roger Delgado. By far the best. Set the template, and he looks as good in a suit as any man I've ever seen.
I hope I take nothing away from Roger Delgado because...
Because he'll shrink you
he'll shrink
to
me.
Death.
He'll shrink me into a Ken doll, and I don't want that to happen.
Gentlemen, I think that's it for another episode of our podcast. I'd like to thank everybody, Pablo Jones for our theme song, Tony Karna for recording all this stuff. Thank you, Tony. Next episode is going to be our special comedy-themed episode. Mm. We're turning off the randomizer briefly in order to talk about the Fourth Doctor adventure, City of Death. And we will have a special guest for you as well. In our death zone, we'll be pitting the Curse of Fatal Death against the Five-ish Doctors reboot.
Yeah.
So until next time, guys, I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Joshua.
And we're saying...
Get off my world!
This was the other innuendo thing that I was forgetting about. The Doctor's time-sensing device.
Yes.
Now, why did they decide on that particular shape for it?
Because time is very sensitive in that region.
You know, like, you have to have, like, the long...
What are you saying here, Calvin?
...protruding thing and the two round dials on either side at the end. You know, I mean, it kind of looks like something. What does it look like? I don't know.
Maybe you like Time Monster too much.
Yeah, maybe I'm a little...